All right, this is Matt Olson for History 669, and I'm doing an oral history presentation with Paul Dolan. He is a former Marine, he's 27 years old, and he's been a student at UW since January of 09?
Yes.
Okay. Paul, could you say your first and last name and spell out your last name for me?
It's Paul Dolan. Dolan is D-O-L-A-N.
All right, and starting off, why did you decide to join the military?
Early on, when I was in high school, my buddies were all filling out college applications. I didn't really feel like that was a career path that I wanted, just because I didn't feel like I had enough like discipline or goal orientation, or like I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I kind of started off talking to like Army recruiters and different military branches, and it wasn't until I talked to a Marine recruiter that I kind of found a passion what I want to do in the future. So then in the summer of 2001, I signed up for the delayed entry program for the United States Marine Corps, and I spent 11 months pretty much more or less on standby until summer of 2002, and so I went to basic training.
Okay, and so did you go to basic training right out of high school then?
Yeah, I had about a month and a half between my high school graduation to my departure for boot camp.
Okay, and why did you join the Marines specifically?
They more or less had the challenge that I wanted. I mean, they kind of have, I don't want to be arrogant, but I mean, they promote the few and the proud, and they have like some high standards, and I feel like they have a history of doing, you know, some pretty incredible things, and I felt like I want to be a part of that. And I mean, just more or less going through their book of information, they just had more career fields and occupations that I want to be a part of. Anything else could provide.
Okay. And what goals did you have going in, and what did you kind of want to achieve when you were in the military?
You mean kind of like?
I guess going into the military, what did you want to do?
Well, initially, one of the career fields I was looking into was embassy security guard. And at the time, I didn't quite understand the requirements to become one. I thought it was just a great occupation. So I initially was in, signed up to be a radar technician, and that was more or less a result of me just taking like some exams and tests and see what fields I was successful in. So, I mean, I really didn't have, you know, real aspirations. I mean, I was ignorant and I wanted to be like a war hero, not realizing, you know, how, I don't know, short-sighted that is, but.
Okay, yeah. No, that's definitely understandable. So do you remember how you felt when you officially became part of the United States Marine Corps? How were you feeling?
That was probably the proudest moment of my life. I mean, I went through like 3 months of just living shit. I mean, they pretty much break it down to you feel like nothing. They build you up to something they can be proud of, and more of a discipline and goal-oriented team member. And then when they put that, they always tell you you're not going to be a Marine. And then when the day you actually put that Eagle open anchor in your hand, it really is a time for you to puff your chest up and feel like you actually accomplished something. So it's actually, yeah, I haven't felt anything like it, I don't think, ever since.
All right. And so you kind of mentioned at first they put you through a lot and they made you feel like you were never good enough to be a Marine. What were those first few days at basic training like for you?
They try to instill an environment of just chaos and confusion. I mean, just the most simple mundane tasks of getting in line or filling out paperwork. You got people yelling in your ears, screaming, you had to get move here, to get over there, come back. I mean, just everyone's giving you different orders and directions. Just for you to learn how that adapt or be comfortable in the uncomfortable situation. And then pretty soon they start, you know, teaching how to make your bed, teaching how to tie your shoes, teaching how to do everything to the most fundamental basic process. So you're pretty much doing everything all the same. And then, like I said, I mean, as training progresses, they teach you how to handle your weapon, fire your weapon, clean your weapon, teach you how to, you know, they teach a lot of the Marine Corps history. They pretty much teach you the fundamental basics of what they want every Marine to the skills to have. And I mean, that's essentially, and then they're good at it. and it worked. Yeah.
And so how did those first few days live up to your expectations? Like, what did you think going in basic training would be like?
Well, talking to some other Marines who went through it, I knew the whole point was to, you know, to train and teach how to be a Marine. So when I showed up, I had the mindset of just do as you're told. When you're told to do it, and you're gonna succeed. And that pretty much got me through, and it worked out great. I mean, obviously it was kind of a quick culture shock to have all that rambling, yelling, and chaotic activity. But I mean, when they said jump, you jump. When they said, you know, push, you pushed. So I mean, once you just got the fundamental basics down, I mean, it was pretty much, not to say smooth sailing, but you didn't get hassled with too much. I mean, the guys who voiced out and talked back are the guys who did not behave as they were supposed to the ones who got all the negative attention. So I was pretty fortunate.
So were there a lot of people that would try to go against the grain? And
yeah, I mean, any way to stand out was probably bad. I mean, you had guys talk back, you had guys wet themselves, you had guys who just move too slow, didn't move too fast. But you have some guys who I just feel like are at a lower level of intelligence. I don't want to say that negatively, but I mean, they just don't comprehend things as quickly. So I mean, they're always kind of like lagging. So I mean, and plus if you're overweight, you get a lot of negative attention and stuff like that. But I mean, yeah, it's better to be, I mean, also in the leadership positions also, one thing they had taught you was, I mean, if you were a squad leader in charge of like 25 Marines, if one of your 25 Marines got in trouble, you would take his punishment instead of him. It's kind of teaching that like you're responsible for everyone, you know, beneath you, and kind of like, or even if like your bunkmate made a mistake, they'd make the other bunkmate do the, you know, the punishment, just to kind of build a camaraderie where it's like you got to be checking ourselves to make sure we all have everything that we need. So I mean, that was something that helped in the future to make sure everyone's on the same page, you know, instead of having someone string around himself making mistakes, kind of corral them in.
Okay. And so you said you started out as a radar tech.
Yes.
How did you decide that you wanted to?
I never really decided. Uncle Sam did it for me. I mean, when I first started out, in the recruiter's office, you take an ASVAB test, and it's pretty much like an intelligence test for the military to see where you rank, where your skills are, where your strengths and weaknesses are. And I scored really high in like math and sciences and mechanical stuff, I guess. So I qualified for intelligence and aviation. So I decided to go into aviation, and I went to a basic Common Core course in Pensacola, Florida for 3 months, which is like basic electronics. And then after that, with my placement in the class, I went to aviation electronics, where you start learning more specific, it's more or less, yeah, it's electronics focused on aviation equipment for about 6 months, and then how to manipulate that and change things. And from that graduation class, I was nominated for a 9-month radar school. So I pretty much spent all that whole year and a half in Pensacola, Florida, going through different 3 classes.
And when was that?
It was just, I want to say like November of 2002 through whatever 18 months is from there, April of like 2004 or something.
Okay. So pretty early then.
Yeah.
Okay.
So.
And you mentioned you wanted to be a embassy guard kind of going into it. How did you decide you wanted to?
Well, just kind of the job descriptions. And initially, what an embassy guard is, it's called a B billet. And there's 3 B billets in the Marine Corps. You have your drill instructor, your recruiter, and your embassy guard. And essentially, you have to do one of those 3 jobs, whether volunteer or voluntold, in order to advance on Marine Corps career, essentially. So once I became a radar technician, or was even going through the process of a radar technician, just the career field and like, I mean, just that job I want to do. I mean, watching guard of American embassies all over the world, I mean, just seems like something I want to do. So it wasn't until like I realized what I had to do it to achieve it, if it makes any sense. So I spent my time as a radar technician in order to apply for that deal later on in my career.
Okay.
So, but I mean, yeah.
So, you mentioned in the email that you've been stationed in Japan, the Netherlands, Panama, Cuba, and Finland.
Yes.
And so, going into the Marine Corps, were you aware that you would be going overseas to different places?
Yeah, that was pretty much one of my main goals was to. I mean, I try to get as far as away from where I was as possible. Not because I didn't like where I was coming from, but it's just kind of like to be put in somewhere completely different is a situation I've never been in before, and I want to kind of put myself out there. And I really liked it. I mean, coming out of school in Pensacola, I picked an overseas duty station right away, and it was Okinawa, Hawaii, or mainland Japan. I was pretty lucky and got Okinawa. And that was my first time out of the States, and it was a pretty, I mean, a lot obviously I was on a military base that was surrounded by other Marines like myself, like my individuals, same common language and everything. But once I walked off past that front gate, I was literally in a completely different culture. So, I mean, so that was kind of like what I wanted. And it was kind of a shock at first, but you kind of got used to it. I mean, the goods and the bads of it. But I mean, it was what I wanted, so I really enjoyed it.
And what were some of the things you enjoyed and didn't enjoy so much about being in Japan?
Well, when I was in Japan, I was a radar technician. And I mean, I was doing my job, but I really didn't really enjoy it. And it was just a lot of tedious electrical mechanical work that I didn't really, like. And the one thing I didn't like also about the perspective of a lot of Marines from the outside is Okinawa was an island that we took hold of since like after World War II, and there's like 7 or 8 military bases on there, and a lot of the population of Okinawa kind of depends on those installations. So there's kind of like a gray area where their culture kind of mixes with ours, and I mean there's a lot of Marines who've come and gone through the island, some who have misbehaved pretty badly. So sometimes every Marine gets perceived from the Japanese or the Okinawans as, you know, not a very pleasant light, I should say. So, but I mean, the few times you get out, it's really nice to kind of engage in the Japanese culture and to meet the people and how they really feel, you know, and just doing something completely different for once was really enlightening. But also then again, you gotta take it with a grain of salt, because there were times when I would have been spat at and frowned upon just because of what the Marine represented to them in their eyes. And it's unfortunate, because when I was, I want to say the summer of 04 maybe, I was on Fatema, which was the Marine Air Base, and we had a helicopter that had mechanical problems and ended up crashing into the local university. Luckily, no one was in there. There's no like Japanese civilian casualties, but I mean, it was a big enough event where the Japanese had enough to say that they wanted us, you know, out of that area, at least the Marine Corps base, because it was a threat to their safety, a threat to their, you know, village, the people around it. And there was an Air Force base probably about, I don't know, maybe 7-10 miles further north of the island. So they wanted us to essentially consolidate the Marine and the Air Force base together. So that was a big push on that political side of the island to move us. And there was different days of demonstrations where the Japanese, as play as they were, they'd call you in advance and give you numbers of how many protesters they'd be having that day and like what kind of signs they'd be protesting on. So, I mean, they would definitely protest our presence there and didn't know they didn't want us, but they did it in a very polite and organized manner that wasn't like, you know, throwing rocks or Molotov cocktails at us. So I mean, that was one of the bad things, where it's kind of like walking out of the gate, you know, they kind of have it, like I said, that label as, you know, a negative image of the Marine Corps, which isn't always the best. But so, and it's ironic, because I actually ended up dating a Japanese girl whose father was a dean of students at that university, or a position of some sort like that. And I remember it's quite common in Japanese culture to meet the family really early on, and I never ever met her family. I was kind of curious by that, and I ran into him at her work, which is like a department store, and he just like flipped out once she saw who I was. And I didn't understand what he was saying, but once he left, I asked her, and she said that if he ever sees us together, she's like disowned from the family. So that was one of those, like I said, I was perceived as something bad before you knew who I was, kind of thing. So.
And you mentioned you had a girlfriend. Were there any cultural boundaries or language boundaries between you two, or between, I guess, you and the general population? Were there any things you had to overcome to try to communicate more easily with the general population that you kind of had to work at? Or was it generally pretty easy to, communicate and live alongside this different culture?
I mean, I think one of the main difficulties was the language barrier. They all primarily spoke Japanese, or a form of Okinawan Japanese, I guess. And then they were educated, they were trained, but English has become a pretty popular language to learn by a lot of people. And unfortunately, you got a lot of, you know, people from the States, from Arkansas, Alabama, Wisconsin, California, don't know any Japanese over there. So, I mean, it's pretty much one side after the language barrier, which is kind of, you know, unfortunate for us. But that's probably the hardest thing, but also just kind of like the small nuances, like tipping in a restaurant, they don't do it. They also kind of take that as like a sign of disrespect. So, I mean, and then, I mean, if you want to have a relationship with a Japanese guy or girl, I guess their signs of, like, respect are a little bit different also. I mean, the way you would engage, if you're going to probably try to date someone, I mean, there's some behavior that's commonplace in the States that isn't really approved, I guess, in Japan. And I mean, even we had kind of like a class on etiquette when you show up to the island, kind of saying, like, this is the things, you know, that's frowned upon. But I mean, even as simple as placement of the chopsticks when you're done eating, or like ordering food, or like, I mean, there's obviously some numbers that was spitting in public and stuff like that, or vulgar behavior. But it was just kind of more or less, like I said, back in the language program, the language issue was you'd be talking amongst your friends and you kind of knew that the people around you might know what's going on, but you never had an idea what they were kind of saying. But I mean, yeah, there was some differences, I guess.
Okay. And how did your friends and family feel about you, you know, leaving and going overseas to foreign lands?
Well, when I was in high school, that was when September 11th occurred, and me being in the delayed entry program, I would thought that it was kind of like, if they needed people, it was obviously like a volunteer service, but after the volunteer service, I actually say runs dry, they would go to the delayed entry program. So I really have fear that I want to be finished in high school. I mean, which at my time, I realized that that's the reason why I joined the Marine Corps. And obviously, as our country got more and more involved, I expected that I'd probably, you know, serve my country in a probably more hostile environment. And that was kind of one of the things that was, I guess I was naive at the time. Like I said, I wanted to be a war hero, which is not anything that should be, I don't know. But like, I spent a year and a half in school. Then I spent a year in Okinawa. And the time in Okinawa was because our sister squadron out of Iwakuni, Japan, we would rotate on 12 or 15 month tours. And when I got stationed in Okinawa, my unit had just returned. So I was never like forward deployed in, they call it K2, it was at border of like Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And our unit pretty much has a standalone deployable air station where we provide radar surveillance and identification, and then we have like a navigational aid who identifies ourselves in the aircraft, and like communications with like an air traffic control tower and like a central command center. So I mean, all those units together, we deploy together. And like I said, that whole unit had just returned when I arrived, so I never was stationed like in a hostile environment or combat zone. And after that 1 year in Japan, that's when I kind of went to the embassy program. In the embassy program, you're non-deployable outside of the field, so you're only deployable within the embassy program. So a lot of times my family was pretty confident. I mean, as worried as they are, I mean, they knew I was never really in much harm's way for the most part, which, I mean, one way is, I mean, I was very fortunate, I guess you should say. So, but.
Okay. So what would a normal day be like, say in Okinawa, Japan? Like, what would you do on any normal day?
You know, primarily we had two radars. We had one called the air surveillance radar, which had 270 nautical miles of like surveillance in the area that would identify aircraft as like friend, foe, or unidentified. Then we had another one. It was a precision approach radar, which is what would land the aircraft like on the runway. And on a daily basis, we would have pretty much maintenance checkups on the equipment to make sure that essentially it was running properly. And you had these giant transformers, receivers, and communication, call them like control panels in between to make sure that the signals that are getting sent on the radar is coming back properly, and everything's like kind of like timed and like gated different like signals and voltages. I mean, it's hard for me to wrap my head around it at this point, but I had to go in there and make sure, and test the equipment to make sure everything was working properly. If anything would need adjusted, I would change it, or I'd clean it, or just do any electrical or mechanical maintenance on it for the most part. And they just had like tasks that were supposed to be done daily, you know, weekly, annually, monthly, you know, quarterly, and everything like that. So then, you know, we would just constantly have a calendar, be working on different projects. And then if anything broke, like it did all the time, then you'd have to like do immediate repair, and they had like programs. You document like what work you've done, you know, what needs to get done next, and then you just kind of like a running list of broken shit that had to get fixed, or equipment just had to be maintained for the most part. And like I said, just coming back from overseas, I mean, there's a temporarily deployable unit. Our equipment is meant to be like torn down, moved, put up for like 3 months just to be a replacement until some more permanent could come into play. So for us, or have our equipment in the desert for 12 to 15 months, I mean, electronics doesn't like sand or the heat. So we had a lot of issues busted we had to fix once it got back. So I spent probably my first 8 months in Okinawa just fixing the broken radars. And I remember it was kind of cool because that was pretty much the first wave of the Marines who got there that wasn't deployed with the equipment. And the longer I got there, the Marines with experience kind of left. So it's kind of like you had to learn from the experts as they were going so you could teach those who come behind you. About 8 months in, we were short manpower, and there was three of us working the equipment, or three or four of us. And with the little knowledge we had and the experience we had from everybody else, we were able to get the radar running, up and running to its ideal operation-like standards. And then the first time since it was brought back from like K2. So that was kind of it was a good day, to kind of like being able to feel like you did something successful, you know? So nice little feather in the cap, I guess.
Yeah. And so when you weren't working, what kind of things did you do?
I was naive 20-year-old, so I was out chasing women and drinking beer, I guess. But all the time. I mean, I took a marathon that I tried to run in, and my buddy was trying to train for like a mixed martial arts competition that was coming in. So we did a lot of basically running and training, and then the Marine Corps had different programs they wanted us to do. And there's like, it's called the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program, and they have like different qualifications you gotta do like through the progression. So there was evenings and days that we would participate in events like that to advance in like martial arts belts. And then they had programs on base for like sporting teams like football or softball you could participate in. And then out in town, I mean, and I would, you know, date Japanese people, or we'd see Japanese movies, or we'd take a vacation to they had like local beaches or museums we'd see. And I just try to get out off the base whenever I possibly could and engage. And one of the things I liked the most, I took a trip up to mainland Japan and to Tokyo, and I climbed Mount Fuji also. And that was kind of another interesting experience, because I went from, you know, a small island, there's a lot of military presence, to a city where I was probably the only Marine within like a large gap of people. And that was pretty much, I would say, the one time when I was in Japan that I actually really felt like I was completely immersed in the culture, just because it was just so different from when I knew in Okinawa. I mean, it was Tokyo, was such a busy city. I mean, I never ever slept. Like I said, I didn't speak a single word of Japanese, and I didn't read any kanji, so I couldn't read any of the signs. I was pretty dependent on trustworthy cab drivers, I guess you could say. But yeah, I mean, I just try to experience a normal life in a foreign land, I guess. I didn't learn any Japanese, unfortunately.
So then after Japan, you went to the Netherlands?
Yep, and that was, so my 12 months in Japan, I got accepted to the MC program. I went through 3 months of school in Virginia, and that's when I was sent to. My first duty station was in the Netherlands, so The Hague.
And how long were you?
I was there for like 9 or 10 months.
Okay, and were you primarily doing embassy work?
Yep, that was my first post as embassy security guard. Yeah.
And what was a day? You know, in Japan, you had a day working with all your electronics and fixing radar and everything. So how would a day be in the Netherlands for you?
It was actually much more like what I wanted. I mean, our primary responsibility was internal security of the American embassy, and we pretty much controlled entry and exit to the building, surveillance of the grounds, And then we maintained, like, they have, like, keys that have access to different areas of the building. There were classified some areas or non-classified in the others. They had monitored that. We monitored visitors coming in and out of the place. And then just pretty much overall, like, if there's any, like, there's the consular sections are most prominently attached to the embassy. So if you have people coming in from that native country who are applying for visas or passports, I mean, if there's any issues with that, you're pretty much supposed to be the first responder to that situation. And then if there's any threat, like a nuclear, biological, chemical threat, or if there's like an intruder threat, or if there's like a mob or an earthquake or a fire, I mean, you're pretty much the one you and the other Marines would be the first one I'd say to take care of it, essentially to make sure that everything, to control everything coming in and out of that building, to make sure there's like nothing classified or of any importance to the U.S. security that's leaving inappropriately, I guess, for the most part. And then, I mean, we would have three different shifts at the embassy. You have like your day shift, your evening shift, and your night shift. And I mean, so working 24-hour security, you obviously had the actual surveillance part you had to do. And then on different days, you had different shifts, to say. You had different responsibilities, I guess, through the daytime, making sure people coming and going, they weren't bringing out computers with them, or they weren't, you know, sneaking in a friend or a, you know. And then at nighttime, you had to make sure, like, all the doors locked, to make sure everything else was secured. And then in order to, you know, ensure that people are probably, like, locking up their class of information, you have to do, like, your daily rounds to make sure all the safes were locked, and go to people's offices and do, like, a detailed inspection of their, like, closed quarters to make sure they weren't, like, you know, leaving sensitive information out, for the most part. And then you just would annotate and document, you know, any security violations or incidents that have happened on the basis, and you would constantly, like, update different, like, information that were available to Marines, because also with the security guard program was you have a lot of, like, it's almost like being like a standalone unit. I mean, you are the only 10 or 20 or however many numbers of Marines you are in that country, so, like, ammunition and weapons, you got to, you know, keep count for and attractive and, like, the tracking of it to and from wherever you are. He had someone responsible for, like, feeding you, almost like a mess hall. He had a guy who was in charge of, like, morale, welfare, and recreation, just to make sure people are getting the proper time off. You had people, we have training to keep up on as far as, like, make sure we knew, like, our defense techniques. We got to make sure we know our, like classification knowledge. I mean, there was just and then also we had people in charge of ensuring, like, our equipment, like our NBC gear, which is like the nuclear, biological, chemical warfare stuff, was up to date to make sure there wasn't holes in it. So there's always like an additional, they call them collateral duties you were kind of responsible for. And that was kind of like on your own time. And so, I mean, it kind of varied depending on what you had responsible for that day, but there's always something to do. And then that was kind of one of the also unique thing was we had like our civilian chain of command and like my military chain of command, because I had like our Marines on compound, you know, and then like our CEO or XO in a different location. But I also had like the Department of State, they'd have like their regional security officers that were in charge of us, so we're kind of like working under almost like, yeah, two people essentially, the military and the Department of State. So in the departments, they had, you know, random tasks that we wanted to perform and stuff like that. So, yeah, kind of varied.
And you said you preferred to do the embassy work. What did you like about that?
It was just essentially more what I thought a Marine should have been doing. I mean, when I was working on radars, I was troubleshooting electrical signals and turning a wrench. I mean, when I was working security for embassies, I was, you know, primarily protecting the lives of American citizens overseas. You know, like I said early on, I felt like I wanted to be a war hero in life, knowing how naive that was, but I mean, I was carrying a weapon. You know, I felt like I had importance. I mean, I was like interacting with people that either had problems or people who had issues. I mean, another thing was like, if you're sitting there in the middle of the night and you have a U.S. citizen come knocking on your door looking for help and you're able to help them out, or even you had like a veteran passing through the country who had needed issues. I mean, it just felt like I had more constructive assistance to people than I did when I was just turning wrenches, I guess. And it was just, I mean, I was a pretty physical, energetic guy, and being able to feel like I was kicking indoors and bringing people down just made me, got my blood rushing, and I kind of liked it. So, yeah.
Okay, and then, so after the Netherlands, you were in Panama?
I was in Cuba.
Oh, you were in Cuba?
They usually do the postings in the embassy program, at least when I was in there. It was three 12-month posts, and they usually consider, depending on your, you do a lot of like background checks and personality tests, and they want to make sure that you're comfortable for certain situations. And most Marines are nominated for like one hardship post, and hardship post could have been anywhere in like Baghdad or Kabul, or even like they call them like intel threat posts, where it's like Beijing, Havana was one of them, so it was like Moscow. So it's all kind of like whether it's a physical threat post or an intelligence threat post. And after my time in the Netherlands, I actually kind of got nominated for my hardship post, which, I mean, I revamped some things in Holland that our XO was pretty impressed with, so my reward was to go there. And, I mean, at the time, Kiba was the only intelligence threat post with a non-fraternization policy that had a restriction from coming to and from the island, that had, because we were only limited to 25 miles at city limits. So as much of an honor was to be stuck there, it was kind of like saying, we trust you and your knowledge to be act independently in a hostile environment, that, you know, you won't, you know, start selling information to the Cubans, kind of thing, you know. So, I mean, you know, the ironic thing with that, I guess, was, well, I guess I did go to Panama next, because I guess you're right. So, oh, this might be kind of confusing. So, so I got selected to go to Havana, Cuba. They have a lot of visa problems. So when I went back to Virginia, I had to get extra training and like updated intelligence information as far as like what to look for in human intelligence gathering, electrical intelligence gathering. I mean, we had a lot more in-depth class with some federal government agencies that taught you how to like look for something, that how not to be targeted, learn their tricks, you know, what's common in that environment, that area, kind of a thing, of what to expect as far as like how to try to extract stuff from you. And that class was about maybe like 3 or 4 weeks. And because I had the visa problems going to Cuba, then they temporarily sent us home for like however long for a paper to get through. And that was kind of one of the games the Cuban diplomats were playing, was there was an argument between the U.S. citizens in Havana and the Cuban citizens working in D.C. about who had the proper number and who could come and go. So a lot of times the Marines were the ones who kind of got, shit on, like they would be extended over past their time in Cuba, and then they would delay visas to the ones who trying to come in. It was because it was a contact and relief post, like, pretty much had to like go to the country, high five the Marine, and he could go. That's pretty much how it worked. So by them delaying these Marines' visas to get out, then they would delay our visas to get in. So I spent about, I want to say like 2 months at home, pretty much just waiting, doing nothing. And that was when they said, I got a call from my battalion in Virginia saying, instead of wasting our manpower, they're gonna send us out to other embassies. And that was when I was temporarily assigned, I guess, to Panama, City Panama. And when I first showed up to that country, they just said, you're gonna be here for anywhere from a week to 3 weeks. So just kind of do your job, and I'm being there for like 3 months. And that was kind of the ironic thing, was because the visa I had to get through was my diplomatic passport and whoever government Cuban agency had at the time. So for me to go to Panama, I had to use my tourist passport. And tourist passport's only good for like, what, 90 some days or something like that. So when I was leaving the country, I think I went beyond my 90 days. And then, I mean, obviously going through customs is a problem. And he said, you don't have like a, because I hadn't been a diplomatic passport at that point. And he said, you don't even have like a stamp to get into the country. And I was like, well, I guess I haven't been called to Mac and Uni on this one. Just walk by you guys. I mean, that was just kind of a little chaos. But yeah, I did go to Panama first for 3 months. Like I said, when I was down there, and I was told I'd be there for 1 to 3 weeks. And as the days went on and on and on, I was there for about 3 months. So,
okay, and so Panama, was that sort of the same, were you doing the same type of things as you were in the Netherlands for the Panama embassy?
Yeah, for the most part, like when I first got there, they were short. I mean, that embassy had one detachment commander, which kind of a staff NCO in charge of the Marines on compound. Then you'd have like ideally like 5 watchstanders, and that'd be 5 watchstanders to survey like those 3 shifts a day. And at the time, before I got there, we only had 3 Marines. So you had three guys, never having a day off, just constantly working the same shift over and over again. So by the time I got down there, it was a lot of relief for them to have a little break. And they also had some, I guess, visa problems. So within a week of me getting there, three of their Marines were supposed to get arrived, showed up. So we went from like a 1-3 to like a 1-7 within like a couple of weeks. So it was pretty much the same responsibilities, a different environment. And I mean, every embassy kind of had like a different purpose. And the one in Panama had a large, I guess, stronghold of like DEA section as far as like the traffic between like Panama and Colombia. So just interacting with kind of like a different perspective of the response to the American embassy area was nice, and getting familiar with the DEA was kind of nice also. So, but I mean, as far as like, I mean, our internal security responsibilities are primarily the same, and the extracurricular duties were pretty much the same as well. So.
Okay, and then, so and then you were stationed in Cuba?
Yes.
In the United States Embassy after that?
Well, it's actually, we don't have like an embassy in Cuba. It was, we are an interest section, which is kind of like a department of the Swiss embassy in Cuba. And however, it's ironic because the Swiss embassy is like a little townhouse, and our building is like 3 miles away, and it's like a 7-story building. So it's kind of like a loophole they have, same thing with the Cubans they have. They're like an interest section of the Czech Republic embassy, and they have like two different buildings also, so.
Okay, so then what were your responsibilities there, primarily the same as in Panama and the Netherlands? And
yeah, there? For the most part, as far as internal security was, it's pretty much the same. But at that point, I was promoted to the assistant detachment commander of the Marines there. So you had your staff NCO, who was in charge for all of them, and then you had your, pretty much it's your NCO, who was in charge of the rest of them, and your responsibilities was kind of more of a supervisional responsibilities of making schedules and ensuring everybody had the proper update information. And yeah, pretty much like that. In case the detachment commander left, you'd be replaced that detachment commander to be the next in line, at least on compound. So, and that was just kind of nice. And I mean, kind of came along with the promotion to going to Cuba was being bumped up from just a wash in into a/ the assistant detachment commander.
And you mentioned the sort of tense relations between U.S. and Cuba with visas and trying to coordinate, you know, which people could be in the country. Were you able to go into the, you know, country of Cuba, and were you able to walk around and be there comfortably, or were there more restrictions on your behavior and what you could do while in Cuba?
There was much more restrictions both on the Cuban state and also by our own government. And I mean, it made things a little bit more difficult, and the Cubans also kind of played almost kind of like a mind warfare or personal warfare against the people there. I mean, primarily the one thing that the Cuban government said was we're not allowed to leave at 25 miles, city limits of Havana. So we couldn't really like, you know, drive out of town and relax on a sunny beach up in Cuba. And then the embassy itself had a non-fraternization policy where the American personnel could not have intimate relationships with the Cubans. And I mean intimate as far as like, you really couldn't like befriend them. You couldn't like, you know, go out and have a beer with them. You really couldn't, you know, get to know someone. I mean, no matter gender, age, you know, race or anything. Which was kind of ironic because as an embassy, you're trying to, you know, promote change, you know, so you're trying to like bring democracy to Cuba, and it's like it'd be difficult for that to do that if you can't, you know, engage with the population. And that was more or less just kind of like a blanket fear that every Cuban was trying to gather intelligence. I mean, they had a problem in the past of like Cuban intel and people, people like American diplomats get themselves in state situations, jeopardizing their careers, and so they're just trying to prevent that. I mean, that was kind of hard. I mean, but, and then as far as like the goods, I mean, I got to really have a lot of respect for the Cuban population because they are really, really resourceful. I mean, that was one of the first thing I realized is it felt like that place like hadn't been touched since the 1960s. I mean, the cars are still all the same 1960s. They got like Russian tractor engines in some of them just to keep them going. I mean, I saw guys building lawnmowers out of like old AC units. I mean, you got guys with like these old motorcycles that are just like scrapped together with like wires and cables keeping going. And I mean, with what very little they have, they're able to, you know, achieve a lot. And I mean, they have like you know, the good and the bad. And unfortunately, a lot of times they had like two different currencies in Cuba, which is like they called the CUC, which was essentially equivalent to the euro, and they had the peso, which was like nothing, so it's like dirt. And then the Cuban population itself primarily had like the peso, and then all the tourists and all the government agencies who like were focused on tourism had the CUC. So I mean, it was kind of hard to see like the tourists built those spot, and then all of a sudden to walk across the street and kind of see that people were living with essentially almost nothing, and that was kind of hard. And I mean, being restricted to 25-mile state limits, I mean, you pretty much were living just like the Cubans were. And one thing that I know ideally was how hard it would have been just to survive on their, you know, their monthly wages that the government would kind of issue them. And just like, you couldn't go down to the grocery store and buy like milk and eggs, or you couldn't buy a soda. I mean, everything you was provided to you was kind of like when it was available kind of basis. I mean, we go to open markets, I remember, and I'd do grocery shopping, and it'd just be like, you know, they would sell vegetables that were in season. They would, and I mean, it wasn't like, you know, you could walk downstairs where everything's all clean and ripe and nice, and you got some shit that's like, I probably wouldn't want to eat, but people are buying it. I mean, just out of necessity. And I mean, like even like potatoes were controlled by the government. So like, if you want to buy potatoes, it's like on the black market and stuff. I mean, it was just ridiculous items like that. And I mean, just really learning how to adjust to that kind of like a lifestyle, which is hard at first, but over time it's kind of a necessity. And that's also another thing was that we were fortunate enough to have like our personal goods. A lot of times the Marines' personal goods was just more or less like a sea bag and like a TV, whatever they could handle to carry with them. But like, you had families who work in the embassy who would have like, you know, bedroom sets and like children's toys and like a whole household they'd be moving down there. And also we'd have the ability to like, you know, purchase like food online, like say like a Sam's Club, and they would pack all that stuff together and like send them these big crates down to us. And a lot of times the Cubans would, I mean, you imagine you have like eight families, like a food shipment all on like one big box together, and the Cubans would say, well, these nine people are approved to get this stuff off, but this one person's paper goes in the rice, so we gotta hold on to it. So instead of holding on one person's stuff, they'd hold on everybody's stuff. So that's kind of the ironic thing was when I was there, it's like, we had these food shipments we were buying, and they would like disappear in like these like Cuban harbors, or we'd get a food shipment like 5 months late, and it's like the boxes have holes, and there's like rat feces in it. So it's kind of like, it's not really any good anymore. But it was just kind of like, I mean, you kind of learn to expect to like, I don't know, just a little bit less. But then again, like I said, as hard as it was for me, I mean, these guys have been doing it for like their whole lives, you know? So it was kind of, it's an eye-opening experience, but it wasn't too bad, I guess. I mean, it was funny, we had one guy, at least when I was, I mean, I would say funny, it's kind of shitty for him, but like, he showed up essentially with like his sea bag, with like the clothes on his back and enough clothes the airport let him get through with, and they held on to his goods for his entire time. He had like the same five pairs of underwear or something for his whole like 12 months. And we had this like big running joke that, you know, Fidel Castro was running around with his like a military uniform on, you know, saying that he stole from my roommate, but it was just kind of funny. But I mean, but again, we're also pretty lucky as far as like the Marines themselves. We had 10 Marines on in country, and we had like a compound with like two houses and like an open space lot. So we had a lot of nice space. And it's funny because from the outside, when I first got there, I wasn't sure if it was like a prison cell. I mean, I wasn't sure if they're like trying to keep people in or out of the place, because we had like a 4 foot tall concrete fence with a, you know, chain link fence above and the constant wire all over the wraps. And I mean, electricity kind of comes and goes sometimes, depending on the weather. And we had this like generator, so when like that part of the city went out, like our lights would pop up, and it's like you just like look out and you could find our house really easy. So it was kind of funny. But I mean, they had problems in the past, like people kind of break into the house and try to steal stuff. But I mean, it's understandable if they had nothing. So, but
you mentioned there were some instances where the government would withhold food or imports coming in. Was that a pretty common occurrence?
Oh yeah, most definitely. And another common thing was like, if your shipment showed up, if you had like a box of VCRs it was supposed to be in, when you open it, it'd just be a box full of like papers and books, you know? Or, I mean, they had like family's goods for like their children. I don't know what necessarily that would be, but I mean, they had, that was held on to a lot. So there was a lot of like families that had some issues and problems, I mean, for the most part. But I mean, another thing they had was, is like they call it the diplomatic pouch. And essentially that is the right of a diplomatic mission to exchange goods back and forth directly between like each other's country. So, and it works a lot for like, you know, intelligence reasons. If they have equipment that they don't want that host nation to know about, they essentially have like a diplomat who carries like a bag of stuff from DC, you know, to our front door and hands it off. So a lot of times that may have been like used to bring some items in that we couldn't get otherwise. So a lot of families had helped through that. But I mean, it was just, you kind of got used to and accustomed to not having your stuff on time and things being broken or things being missing or stolen. And I mean, yeah, just, I guess you kind of got used to it for the most part.
Okay, so so you were in Cuba for a year then? You said there were three 12-month
embassy. Yep, and I was pretty lucky because I got out of there in about 13 months because like by the time I arrived there, by the time my new visa showed up, I was going to somewhere else. And another thing was, I got there so late, and you're always like kind of rotating the same like window. Like you always graduate, you always change and go to the same embassies within like 1 or 2 months. And like my time, like my window for Cuba, I don't know what date it was, but I essentially had a post I was supposed to go to, and like I was gonna be A/ in Astana, Kazakhstan. And I was gonna replace a friend of mine actually in that position. He was telling me like how much he hated it, and I wasn't looking forward to going to that post. But because of like my visa issue, I wasn't able to leave. And then that Astana post needed a replacement like ASAP, so they just kind of switched people around and they replaced them. So for a while I was like kind of undesignated. And then one day I woke up and my boss was like, well, you got you a visa to get out of here. He's like, in 3 or 4 days, like, we need you to go pick an embassy. I mean, it wasn't like in the window. I mean, there wasn't like, no one else was moving but me. So they just gave me like a list of countries that needed a Marine. I just like got to pick one. So I made one night of phone calls and I was fortunate to pick Helsinki, Finland. So I went out there.
Okay. And what led to you picking Finland?
Well, at that time, I was already kind of like working like online degree. I kind of knew at that point I was trying to get out of the trenches of the military. And I kind of considered like my farewell tour, I guess you could say. Like I wanted a place where I could, you know, get off of the 25 miles of the island or maybe participate in the environment a little bit more often and just, I don't know, chase girls and drink beer in a country where I feel safe in, I guess.
And how was Finland then compared to your expectations?
I absolutely loved it. And I think a lot went into the fact that like that was probably my first post where I actually got like truly involved with like the culture and the people like of the country. I mean, a lot of times when you're on these embassy compounds, you're obviously surrounded and you have like a small community of Americans you're kind of working with and living with. So you just kind of stay isolated at some points. And at this time, I mean, I hit the ground running. I mean, I joined like a local rugby team. I started playing like a Finnish softball league, which is mildly different than like American softball. And I would just kind of like, I would make time to just, I mean, to go out and meet new people and try new things. And the great thing about the rugby team was it's like, I mean, there's some differences and nuances of different cultures, but it was just nice that this team would like travel different parts of the country and had like a nice boss let me kind of do it. And I would, you know, see parts of Finland that a lot of people didn't see, you know, from the very southern tip to the most northern tip. And then even I was able to, took a lot more time off to kind of go travel around other parts of the area also. So, I mean, I just, you know, embraced every moment I did off of work. I mean, I went from having a heavy load of responsibility when I was in Cuba, you know, which I didn't mind. I mean, I encouraged it, but once I knew I wanted to transition out, I just kind of went to Finland and just had less responsibilities. I just pretty much enjoy my free time a lot more, and yeah, so I liked it a lot better.
And what were kind of your work responsibilities then?
Well, I went, when I was in Finland, the security thing was pretty much still the same, and then I was in charge of training, and in charge of training, you had to make sure that, like I said, like we have like defense techniques to be responsible for. I had to make sure all the Marines were up to date on that, to get constantly trained on it. I had to make sure that we had our weapons handlings properly done on such a regular basis. There's like force continuums, like knowledge. You have to be fully aware of like your authority of when to escalate a situation of violence or decrease a situation, how like just like a wide variety of things that we're taught and trained how to behave and, you know, do our job, that God has to like make sure we're doing on a regular basis to make sure we're fresh up on the material. And then there are things that are constantly changing from like the schoolhouse. I mean, you had Marines out in the program for 3 years. I mean, they might, you know, teach you something differently now. Because I know one big thing was we went from a PR-24, which is like a old, like plastic police batons with a handle on it that was such a pain to carry and manipulate, to an ASP. So one of our responsibilities was to make sure that everybody was learning how to, you know, operate and handle our classical ASPs properly, you know. So it wasn't like we all could go back to Virginia to learn how to do it again. We had to like adapt out there and be trained, and I have to train everybody else. So it was nice. It was manageable. It wasn't anything I wasn't familiar with my other post. So I mean, I liked it. So.
Okay. And then you mentioned also that as something you would, as an experience you would like to talk about, you were part of the G8 summit in 2007.
Yeah, when I was in Havana, Cuba, when the G8 summit came around, they have these small Marine security details that go out for special security details. And a lot of times, if it's like the president's going somewhere, the vice president, secretary of state, that they are constantly moving all over the world, that you have like, I'm gonna say like packs of like five or six Marines who go up there 2 weeks before they arrive to set up security, ensure security, and then like a week after their departure. So they call them like VIP trips. And that was the like kind of the VIP trips I was picked to go to. I mean, I didn't know a lot about it before I went, but they picked me from Cuba, and then they had like four or five of the Marines at Africa post that they all sent up to Berlin, Germany to get our debrief before they sent us up north to Von der Munde, Germany. So, I mean, that was like a real honor, like once I realized like where I was going and what I was gonna do, just because I had a lot of friends who were doing these like Secretary of State tours. I mean, it's, like I said, good Marines are kind of reward that, you know, responsibility. I mean, they're not gonna send somebody who's not qualified or isn't doing a good job to go. So for all the Marines in the world to get picked, and for the G8 summit for that year, like I said, I was pretty honored. And it was an amazing experience. And it also it was an opportunity for me to express like my leadership skills in a setting that was kind of underestimated in. I mean, we were faced with a lot of more difficulty up there than we had expected. And the bosses, I guess I was introduced to and worked for when I was up there, were impressed by the things that we've done and accomplished what little we had. And once I got back to Cuba, they sent like a debrief report, and I actually had a lot of shining, you know, marks. And I had, so I mean, like I said, it was nice to go there, do good things, and be recognized for it. So it was nice.
You said there was a little more difficulty than they thought would be. What?
Well, primarily, what we were slated to do was, when we got briefed in Berlin before we went up there, was we worked, like I said, internal security is kind of like our specialty. So we get up there so early, like I said, 2 weeks before the president would arrive, that we would pretty much like block off a section of the hotel. And then we would make sure that everything leaving out of there is supposed to be going, and everything coming in, you know, had the right serial numbers, the right, you know, either the people had the right authorization to be there or the right equipment was supposed to be in there. But that G8 summit at that time was the most protested, and like they were bringing people from like trains and like buses and like cars from all over like Europe to come and like protest one G8 summit. I'm not sure if you mean the time our chief of our commanding officer, our President Bush wasn't very popular, and there's other, you know, foreign figureheads that weren't very popular also. I mean, if G8 summit is pretty much the top eight industrial countries, you know, get together, see what they can do better. I mean, people didn't like the policies they were doing. I mean, I remember like YouTube was like saying how they're going to protest. I mean, it was just like the Nazis hated it, the hippies hated it. I mean, everybody hated it, and they were just all gonna go there and like bitch about it. So it was like you went there with like our standard operation security systems, but it's like it wasn't sufficient for what the environment was. I mean, they had to require us. I mean, like I said, we were supposed to primarily be like internal security, and pretty soon I talked to my RSO, and they need us out there, us Marines, to be almost like crowd surveillance. I mean, they wanted to make sure, I mean, we were literally kind of like living amongst the people for temporarily. So they had the city sectored off, in like, you know, different zones, and you're pretty much in normal clothes walking around, and you kind of keep a keen eye to see if the situation's like escalating, if you get a bunch of knives out there throwing bricks at people, or if they were like, you know, if you overheard people saying, you know, I'm going to the G8 summit, they're going to break this or do this. Or I mean, we pretty much were working like crowd details, and it was a lot more involved than I expected, because I remember one time I was sitting there just walking around, and I saw like a giant riot pretty much escalate from people that are taking bricks out of the street and throwing them at each other. So I called my phone, I called my officer, and I was like, you know, we got, you know, escalation, this color, this code red. I mean, things are getting escalated pretty quick. And before I could even hang up, I could already see like these almost like tanks come like driving up, and they were essentially like fire hoses and like riot gear, and the hose would be shooting out like CS and like water, a combination of both. And they were just like closing the crowd down just to get them all out of there. And I was like, I remember like running, like, I mean, it's like also it's like self-inflicted pain on my part. So I mean, they were reacting very quickly, and just kind of like, I mean, at that point we had a lot more involvement with like the German police, the German military. I mean, they had like I remember, like I said, I went there thinking I'd be making sure the DEA, the FBI, and the CIA were coming, going, they're supposed to, the communications were supposed to be coming to. But then again, here I am, I was like, what, 23, and I'm sitting amongst a table full of like the head of like Air Force One, I mean, head of like President Security, I mean, German police, I had like German military, I mean, all sitting around the table explaining what we're going on, what we need help with, you know. So now it's like, the head, like I said, I wasn't supposed to be there, but they needed me to, and I did it, I mean, and they were pretty surprised about what the small few memories they had to do to actually accomplish. So I mean, it was, like I said, another good thing for us to do and actually participate a little more above and beyond what they required us to, which is kind of helpful. So, yeah, it was kind of nice. And I mean, yeah, it went well. I mean, at one point there was some inner conflict once with like some of the Marines and others, another organization. So there was an early departure. So you kind of were like undermanned for a while, which is unfortunate. But like I said, we made do with what we got. And I mean, they kind of rewarded us, which was nice, because the four Marines I was with were able to meet the president right in front of Air Force One before he departed, so that was pretty nice. And like I said, an event that big with so many people, I mean, not only were we, you know, coordinating things for our own security, our own president, but we had to like work around, you know, these figureheads of the like, prime ministers and leaders of these other countries. So there's a lot more involved that I was involved with than I expected. So it was really interesting, like I said, a great honor to do it, and a great honor to meet, you know, the president that we had at the time. So, yeah.
So, how was meeting the president?
It was great. I mean, it's kind of a funny story. Most times, it's like a little small shake your hand. But like I said, I had other Marines when I was in Cuba who had met him in the past, and a lot of the military or I guess government workers, they have these things called like challenge coins, and it's essentially like represents like your unit or what member you belong to, and you kind of give them as gifts, or your friends have them, and if you have kind of like a token of where you've been. So I had two Marines from Cuba who met the president in different situations who gave him like a challenge coin or our embassy coin. So when I was going to go to GA, something I knew there'd be a possibility for me meeting him, I didn't want to give him his third coin. So I did something different. I brought like a t-shirt. And the day of the event, I mean, there's obviously like a lot of security that goes into it. And so we're kind of like shuffled around, making sure they're patting us all down. And we're sitting on the tarmac, and you can see the helicopter land before he walks across to the Air Force One. And what I did was I shoved the t-shirt like in my belt. So the president, you know, was shaking all our hands. I shook his, and I was like, you know, sir, it's been an absolute pleasure and honor to meet you. And he's like, on behalf of the Marines of, you know, Embassy in Havana, Cuba, I want to present this t-shirt. So I like pull up this t-shirt out of my jacket. He takes the thanks before, and he like throws it to like one of his hand days in the back, and he thanks all of us for our service and appreciates what we did. He walked on. You know, I felt good about it. Nobody else knew what I was going to do, so they're kind of shocked, the other Marines I was with. And then one of the Secret Service guys walks over to me, and he's like, did you tell anybody you're gonna do that? And I was like, no. He's like, we don't like people pulling shit out of their pants when we're on the president. He's like, your head was almost a pink mist for a second there. And I was like, well, I'm glad no one shot my head off because I gave him a t-shirt. But if you ever see President Bush running out of the Havana Cuba t-shirt on, you know I gave it to him. So I kind of broke the rules on that one, but I was pretty proud of it.
Yeah. And you said you worked in pretty close contact with German authorities and German police. How was that?
It was, like I said, they had their responsibilities. Like I said, probably like crowd control. I mean, they were always like in riot gear for the most part. And our interaction was more or less of like how we viewed the crowd. You know, if there was a threat of a zone where we thought was need like more security, because they had essentially all these roads lined up for like evacuation or entrance standards, and we would monitor them. So we'd pretty much tell them, you know, this road's clear, this road's not, you know, direct traffic this way. I mean, this more is hostile. So, I mean, they were real professional for the most part. I mean, like I said, my interaction was more than I expected, but it wasn't anything real severe. It's more essentially just me telling them, you know, this guy's on the brick of this guy, or like this road's got a bunch of hippies sitting in it, don't bring a car this way kind of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, like I said, that was as much hassle as it was. I remember it went by quite smoothly. And it was just like I remember sitting there where it's like there's so much like this large amount of security. And I remember one of the biggest deals was, well, two big things was, they had one was like boats, because this is like on the water. And they built like a $17 million fence around this like resort so that no one could get in. But these guys came like cruising in like a little like watercraft, and one of these giant like German carriers was trying to stop them, and essentially ran them over. I mean, that was kind of a big deal, which I thought was kind of funny. But they also was, Bono apparently was, like I said, was protesting everything. And I remember like when one of the scenes of like, President Bush was like meeting some other like, you know, leaders of the countries, and all of a sudden Bono's there. He just like walks up, and I'm like, how the hell can I have all these fucking people here? You know, there's like 5 million protesters, and Bono somehow gets on here. You think one person might say, hey, this guy doesn't belong here? I mean, I'm pretty sure he doesn't have like a pass to get through here. And then somehow he's also like staying in our he put us like a whole like hotel for like our security and personnel to be staying at. And I remember he was even in that hotel room. So I'm like, how can like we be back at this whole place and him stay here? And then I remember people were just like, Bono, Bono, there's autograph, like freaking out. And I'm like, at the time I hate that band. I was like, I never even liked them. So I was just like, I just couldn't stand it at all. And I was like, and the worst part was, as a security officer, if I would walked over and kicked them out of there, I probably would get in trouble for it, you know? Oh no, this was funny, but yeah. So.
Yeah. So that was the G8 summit, and then you were in Finland after Cuba. So then after Finland, you were transitioning out of the military?
Yep, and the thing was, like I said, with all the visa problems and like me being stuck in countries longer or shorter than I was supposed to be in, I was only supposed to be in Finland for like ideally like 6 months. But it was such a pain or a stress in the embassy to lose a Marine, like to train a Marine for so many months and to lose him so many months afterwards. So I pretty much was asked by my command to extend my contract another 6 through the full 12-month tour. And that was kind of the reason why when I got out, my times were always kind of like a little different. But like I said, while I was in Finland, I already applied, was accepted to go to Madison, because I got my online degree or an associate's in general studies, and I didn't understand how college worked. So like I pretty much got accepted, I did my classes, and then Uncle Sam says, do more 6 more months for us in the embassy, and I'm like, all right, sweet. So I just did 6 more months. So when class registration came up next time, I went to sign up, and I'm like, why aren't I a student? And so I called the, you know, UW registration. They're like, well, you were accepted for last semester. You never signed up to a job. You got to reapply. And I'm like, well, I said, when can I reapply again? They're like, well, registration just quit 2 weeks ago. We're done. So you can do it next week. And I'm like, I'm leaving this country, you know, relatively shortly. They say, well, we can't do anything for you. So that's kind of where I try to pull one of my cards, and I went to the ambassador, and I was like, ma'am, I was accepted to this university before. I mean, I got my degree. I mean, the only thing was I was like shorted because I didn't know. I mean, I was just naive. I'm dumb. I'm sorry. And it's ironic because, I mean, 11 bachelors are pretty well off, I should say. And she has a building named after her in Arizona State University, ASU. So she's like, what do you want to go to Madison for? You should go to ASU. And I'm like, well, as a Wisconsin resident at that time, Morris asked me to go to Wisconsin. So she was honored and privileged, and she wrote me a letter. And then like a week ago, I sent a letter back to Madison saying, yeah, go ahead and register your classes. So I was lucky. And like I said, I pretty much went from between me leaving country in Finland and my separation process, which is about a week or two when I was in Virginia, I was like in Madison 3 weeks before class started. So I was already kind of like trying to find a place to live. So that was a pretty rapid changeover when I was up from Finland to
Madison. How would you say the transition coming back home was? Was it pretty smooth, or did you have some trouble?
It was much more difficult than I expected. Because, I mean, at that time, I mean, from what I experienced, I felt like I could take on the world and win. You know, I mean, I've done a lot of things that I felt like I was proud of. I had a lot of responsibility, I had an identity, and then I come here, and it's like, I mean, obviously there was a lot of like things I had provided for me, like a steady paycheck. I mean, they looked after the Marines as far as like health services and like make sure you're fed properly. Like kind of, you know, I had like a job. And once I get out of here, it's kind of like I didn't have my rank on my collar anymore. I couldn't, you know, tell people to do things anymore. I didn't have a place where to live. So it was like doing all this stuff and coming home, crash my dad's couch for a couple of days. This wasn't thrilling for me anymore, you know? And it's just kind of like learning to get back on your feet, do everything all over. And, you know, so I found like a little tiny room close to campus and one of them was like SOAR programs. And it was just, I was like a complete fish out of water. I mean, I had to take my placement exams for my English, my math again. And my brother at the time was going to school here. And I remember like the night before my placement for math, he's gonna sit down with me and explain what I had to know. And he was going over like unit circle stuff and like equations. And I'm like, I don't ever think I ever saw that. And I was like, I can put rounds on range, hit the target. I was like, but I can't tell you what the hell the pi equals to, you know? So, I mean, that was kind of like, you know, so I had to start from the very bottom of like all, a lot of my education stuff, which is kind of like a kick in the nuts. But I mean, like I said, I wasn't here and I didn't really know how prestigious I had to develop Madison was. So it was a necessity. And another hard part was, it's like in the military, it's like things are structured. Like I knew my agenda every day. I knew what I was going to do. I had a goal. I was oriented towards, you know, to get somewhere. And here it's like I walk on the campus. It's just kind of like vague. It's like I'm going to class. And unless like I sit there, it's like now it's over. Now what? No. And I had a lot more spare time than I really anticipated to have. And a lot of times I would just get like angry. I mean, I felt like I was in the mindset of like everyone should behave, act like a Marine. You know, and it's like a lot of kids. I'm saying kids, but like college students don't. I mean, they're very liberal with their time. They're very liberal with what they say. They're very, I mean, one thing that just pissed me off immediately before was punctuality. Like I'd be sitting there in class and kids walking in, I would be vocal about my distaste of them showing up late, you know? Or kids packing their books before professors done talking. Because I mean, it's like, you know, you're the dumb one. He's the smart one. You show him respect and you're learning from him. Why, you know, it's not just like one kid getting ready. It's like the whole class getting up. And it's like, I was like, how the fuck does this even like fly, you know? How come no one stands up here and starts like just chewing ass and cussing up a storm? So I mean, it was just like, I mean, I also wanted to say like the Marine Corps mindset is, you know, like I said, very rigid. You know, you have, you know, right and wrong coming here. I don't want to sound rude or vague, but it was surrounded by hippies and homos, you know, and I just wasn't familiar with it. So it was just like a kind of a drastic life change, you know. And like one of the things I liked the best was, like I said, this organization helped me a lot, especially professors, because we had like-minded people, like my experiences in both transitions phases who were kind of looking for the same thing. And like it kind of was a pleasure for me to like get my roots or get my grounds again, you know, where it's like I didn't feel so isolated or desolate or all by myself, you know. And it really helped the transition process. But I mean, it definitely, you know, it wasn't easy at first. And I kind of remember, like, even in the SOAR program, like, talking to people. Yeah, all these kids, like, you know, I want to do this, I want to do this. You know, and they're relatively pretty young, you know, we're transitioning students from, like, other schools who have orientation. Here's a 26, 27-year-old guy who doesn't blend in very well. And he has someone trying to say, hey, monkey, what do you want to do, you know? And it's like, I got no idea what the class is. And I remember signing up for a class I wanted to take, and the advisor's like, that's, like, I mean, it was like a, I just didn't take a class I thought was interesting. So I took like a Middle Eastern like philosophy or class, and she's like, that's like four books, all this writing and this much paper. So I'm like, okay, I can read. And she's like, and sure enough, it's a lot of work, but I mean, it's like I said, it's a learning experience, like how to read transcript. But anyway, like I liked it, you know. But and also I had to take a class, and one of them, they I'm glad I recommended it to me. It's kind of like adjusted like campus lifestyle. I forgot what it was like some counseling psychology of some sort. It's like one credit course. But it was one of the projects in that course was kind of like meet new people and expressing yourself as you want to express yourself before. And one of the assignments was like go to a group or student organization that you are not familiar with, or you'd never ever go to, and just participate. And I mean, I think I was maybe one of the only students who actually did the assignment, I think, because I think people went to like a pizza party and said how they hated sausage versus pepperoni or something stupid. And I went to like a lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual, LGBT, whatever party, like a function. And I mean, at first, when I first got there, I was, I mean, extremely uncomfortable. I didn't really like it. I mean, I wasn't very familiar with anybody, and I didn't have anything in common, and I was being more derogatory than like supportive. And I was very sour, I guess you could say. And then, you know, sitting around and listening and softening up, and I mean, what very little bit I participated in, I mean, I kind of realized that, you know, we are vastly different, you know, and whether, you know, we share the same opinions or not, I mean, we're still human beings, and we still have, you know, certain rights, you know, to be, you know, are guaranteed. And, you know, I saw some things in their perspective. I mean, they were working on an event to bring awareness to, like, hate crimes against people, you know, and, like, just, they had stories of people being violated or abused, or even people on campus just sharing their stories, you know, and I was kind of sitting there, like, that's some pretty fucked up shit. I mean, I swear in here, but I mean, that's some things that, you know, shouldn't be going on. So, I mean, I kind of like, I learned a little bit about myself about just how, prejudice I was beforehand, I guess you should say. I mean, preconceived ideas of things. And that just kind of showed me that, hey, sometimes you go into things a lot more often with an open mind than you should with a closed one, you know? And that was kind of an eye-opening thing. That's, like I said, more involved here on campus. And like I said, pretty soon, I started going to class late. That was when I started realizing that my transition was okay. But no, and that was kind of like, I learned to embrace and I kind of liked. I mean, I'm trying to maintain the good qualities I had in the Marine Corps, and you know, but I mean, I can definitely see how I'm currently enjoying like, the flexibility of the schedule, and you can take on more things, you kind of juggle things a different way. And like, I mean, it's all like a transition process. It's like I was training how to be a Marine for so many years, so there's no way I should have even expected to get out of the Marine Corps and be like perfect civilian again. So, I mean, like I said, it took a process, it took a while. And the few things that, like, I mean, like I said, I was very fortunate. I was never stationed like a combat zone. So, like, I mean, there's veterans out there who are transitioning, who are dealing not with just an environment change, but also like a psychological and emotional difficulties of coping and methods, which is a lot different for me. But I mean, it's just nice that I said for the special best to be here where veterans can come, you know, as a resource. I mean, some guys get out of the military and they need like that attachment kind of again. Some guys get out and they just want to get as far away as possible, which I can understand, you know. And sometimes they want to come in here and use us when they need us, which is understandable. But just for me, I mean, it was just nice to have it available. And I also was recommended, I joined like a professional fraternity. I felt it was important for me to get more involved in the community because this organization primarily does like support and resources and like I don't like outreach. Well, not say, I'm gonna say outreach, but they like more support resource stuff like that and like provide things for students, I guess. But so the reason I joined the professional fraternity was just because like they do more outreach. I mean, they're going out to communities. I mean, they're going out there helping assisted living people. They're doing like the Rake-a-thon things. They're going out and doing like demonstration shows for like, elementary schools and like Boy Scout events. I mean, that was kind of like the one thing I kind of missed that and also joining that organization. It's kind of like now I'm putting myself in a group of people who are, you know, experiencing stuff for the first time as 19 to 23 year old people, you know, away from home. So it's kind of like me readjusting how to be, I'm gonna say not say normal, but just like more civilianized, of like not to cuss or swear or expect someone to fucking jump when you say jump, you know. So, and like I said, I also gotta help the process where it's like, I mean, I love these guys' mindsets, but I can't hang out with them all the time. It's kind of nice to be around them who have like a different perspective on life also. So it's kind of nice. And like I said, yeah, so. I mean, it's ironic because we had a guest lecture we brought, Professor Best brought a guest lecture to campus. His name was Kyle Hausman Stokes. And one of his things was he was talking about transitioning for the military, which I thought was an important message. And when he was talking, I just couldn't believe. I was like, you're like, that's the stages that like I went through that helped me. And I was like, we're like things that people need to do. And I was like, it's just, it was funny for someone to say to do something. And it's like, you know, and you're doing it. So, I mean, it was really helpful. And like I said, the transition, a lot of times more difficult for other people also because, I mean, like my buddy Steve, he's like a different state he's going to. He's a wife and two kids, you know. And so this is a difficult transition, you know, for a lot of people for different reasons, especially with their different various military experiences also to put on top of everything. So, but yeah, I mean, I feel comfortable again in society where I can embrace and, you know, maintain my identity as a veteran, as a former Marine, and, you know, proud to be a UW Madison student and hopefully benefit both sides of the campus as veteran and as a student. So, yeah, it wasn't easy, but I got here.
That's all that matters. You said you joined a professional fraternity that would kind of do community outreach stuff. Mm-hmm. What motivated you to do that, and what were some things you really enjoyed about it?
The one I joined was a chemistry fraternity. Like I told you before, I was a science major. At the time, I was trying to go for kinesiology or biology or zoology. So I just remember one day, I was in the chemistry building to buy this textbook for my class, and they had all these flyers in it. And I was just getting sick and tired of going to class, coming here, going home, you know. So I was like, well, fuck, I'm going to lose these science demo shows. So I went there, and they tried to recruit new people, and I said, well, shit, whatever. Went to a few more of them. I memorized the need memorized, and they, like I said, and they were starting. I mean, like I said, yeah, I felt pretty isolated. I didn't really know anybody here. You know, I had a brother going to school, but he's pretty busy. He's resting stuff like that, and guys had family, so I felt like I needed to like get out of my room. You know, and that was kind of one of those things. Like they reached out to me, so I reached back out to them, and like I said, the things I like the most is it's like they provide a. I mean, I'm not good at chemistry, which is kind of ironic. I hate it, but I mean, but like. I mean, as far as the outreach programs, I mean, looking at what I like about it, I mean, Is that what you're kind of asking?
Yeah. Like, what were some of the things that you were able to do that you really enjoyed?
Like I said, the assisted living kind of things. You go out there, we've had, like, bingo nights. We played the older folks. And we would have, like a casino night. We'd go out there and play different all various cards games. We did, like, a wreckathon thing where in the fall you go out there and rake people's lawns who aren't able to do it for themselves. We participated in, like, the polar plunge. And, I mean, a lot of times you just kind of go out and meet new people, meet other organizations, other groups of people. And then, you know, we focus a lot as a chemistry fraternity as, like, bringing awareness to, like, sciences and the curiosity. So things like BioCore nights and, like, elementary middle schools, we'd go out and teach these kids how to, like, you know, the wonders of physics, of chemistry and science, you know. And it's just kind of cool to see these kids' faces light up when a volcano explodes, kind of explain it to them, you know. And like I said, the BioCore and elementary schools and even, like I said, these Boy Scout days, it's just nice to kind of, like, you know, answer a few kids' questions and maybe raise a little curiosity, maybe, you know, because I remember when I was, how old was I? 8th grade, I got nominated to go to some, like, science fair, like, science camp. I mean, I used to love it, and I remember I was honored one time to come to Madison as a student to, like, come to, like, their engineering hall and see some of their science experiments, you know. And it was kind of nice to say, like, you know, maybe looking back, I was that kid that's standing across the table from where I am now, you know. So maybe just piquing a little interest in the kid or even helping out someone else in the community, you know, which is nice, you know. And so, I mean, it's really got to be more involved. I mean, even outside the group, I mean, even the classes are kind of nice where I had, like, a psych class where to get extra credit, you had to go volunteer at, like, a local school, which I would never would have done because I never really thought of it. But they kind of, like, an underprivileged school, and I spent 10 or 15 hours there. And you kind of learn a lot about yourself. And like I said, I proceeded the wrong way, I guess you should say. I went to this environment where I thought it would be, like, hostile, or not hostile, but different from my experience. I was in one of the cold, hard marine, like, face, and all of a sudden, I had wild kids around. I was like a zoo at first. But by the end of that, I was done volunteering there, I kind of realized, you know, opened up. Like I said, these kids are different because they're, you know, not say different, but they're younger, a little more mature and transitioning, so it just got behaved differently around them. So, I mean, like I said, it's a learning process, and I loved it. And then, like, volunteering at the VA hospital, I kind of like going over there just to, I mean, I'm not really in dire need of a lot of help as far as my abilities now, but I know there are some veterans who do. So hopefully I can help them out now. Maybe someone will help me out later when I need them. So, I mean, that, I'm going to say that it's a catalyst, but it kind of opened my eyes to get more involved, whether through school or whether through my own actions to get involved in the community. I enjoy it. And also throughout the years, or throughout the years, I guess, my volunteer time here has led to, like, a couple leadership positions, and now I'm, like, the president of this organization, which is kind of nice. It's kind of like the changeover is a lot of rapid, so you have a lot of people who have an idea of where they want us to go, and just to keep it, to see it progressively moving forward in the right direction is just kind of nice to see also. So it's just trying to keep everything balanced but get enough involvement in the community that this doesn't really provide me also is really nice. So, but yeah. I'm not gonna be a chemist, I don't think, but I'll definitely teach kids. But I like it.
So why did you choose to come to UW after your time in the military?
My mother went to school here, and uncle went to school here, and I mean, as UW Madison, essentially, when I think of college in Wisconsin, is kind of the school I would stand out the most to me, you know. And I felt like if I'm gonna apply for what I would consider the best. I'm gonna say it's better than anybody else or worse than anybody else, but I mean, like I said, it stood out to me. And they have a large reputation and a big impact, like, worldwide, so I figured I'll try to take them around. So
going off of that, how has, we kind of talked about your early experiences with transitioning with school. So how has school been going more recently, I guess, once you kind of transitioned into more, I guess, civilian-friendly lifestyle? How did school go for you?
It's going better, but it always is kind of changing. You kind of got to stay flexible. It's kind of got to learn how you learn kind of method, you know? And the way, like, a history class is taught in access or a writing class is different than, like, a science class, you know, or a lot of classes, like, even, like, a math class. So it's like, I can't really attack every class the same way. And I just noticed that as an individual, I like a lot of, like, smaller groups. So in the past, I've worked with Guts, either for or with them. And then, there's services on campus that reach out to people in need. You know, I try to form study groups. But, I mean, It's still a struggle. I mean, the coursework here isn't easy, and you got to find resources that help you succeed. I mean, there's so many times where it's like I just like bust my ass on exam, then I fail, and it's just like, you know, it's like why I work so damn hard when I could just went out and drank all week and do the exact same damn thing, you know. Or it's like where, you know, there's times where it's like you have to like manage your time to where, you know, you don't get as much studying for one class you want to, but you do better on it, you know. So it's just kind of like, it's kind of like, I mean, I always kind of see the constant struggle where it's like, you gotta just put everything behind you and just keep, you know, focusing on the future and do the best you can. But I mean, like I said, I really focus a lot and get like outside help with like study groups and like tutors. And I mean, I can't sit in the library and stare at a book for 8 hours and learn everything again, you know. I gotta sit and bounce ideas off, talk with them, and quiz each other, you know. I gotta kind of go over things. I'm more of an interactive learner than just reading it, you know? So I mean, I've had problems in the past, but I've found, like I said, you know, ways to overcome it. So
okay. And you kind of mentioned before how you tried to take the positive aspects of what you were taught as a Marine, and you tried to keep those as you kind of became more used to being a student. So what would you say helped you with classes that you kind of learned as a Marine? Like organization or time management, something?
Oh yeah, yeah. Organization, time management, are two big ones. It's kind of like knowing, like, you know, this is how much time I got in a day, and this is gonna I gotta achieve, you know. I have to sacrifice some things, but you gotta like, kind of know like where your strengths and weaknesses are, and you gotta focus your time at, which is one of them. And also, it's kind of like being a team player, and like different classes have like group projects, you know. It's kind of like, well, if the one guy doesn't bring his part of the conclusion of the science project, guess what? We have a science paper, but the conclusion. It's like, you know, so it's kind of like you have to have reliable and dependable. And dependability, sometimes I find on campus, isn't a common trait, you know. If you call someone to meet up with somewhere at a place, you expect them to arrive at on time. You know, and granted, people have problems catching the bus or whatever, but you just don't gap people off. And sometimes you can feel, you know, and it can be very rude, but I mean, like I said, punctuality, organization, and also kind of like determination. Like I said, it's kind of like you get kicked in the stomach and you can get knocked down. You just gotta get back up and keep going at it. I mean, a lot of people out here are struggling, and it's not an easy school to go to. And it's just kind of like my mindset when I fail, I mean, literally, it's like there's a lot of worse places I could be right now. You know, it's like I'm sitting here in an air-conditioned room, you know, bitching about why I failed this exam, when it's like I have a fucking buddy, you know, sitting in a sandbox getting shattered right now. You know, it's like, where would I rather be? You know, it's like, how is this one exam gonna, you know, impact me in the future? You know, it's like, it's little. You put things in perspective, you know. Granted, it has some level of importance, but it's just, you can't just dwell over things, you know. And it's just kind of like that perspective has helped me so many times over and over again. And also, it's like just like proper respect for professors. So many times I hear kids talk to a professor like, hey, you or the TA. It's like, you give them the proper respect they deserve, you can give it back. And there's a lot of times when I've gotten, like, you know, assistants, like when I'm at that borderline where they bump me up a little bit, where I can get the most if I miss a class, when they, you know, when they say, you know, they know who you are, and you know, you're respectful and you're polite about it. So, I mean, it's just a courtesies and customs that you, I mean, that's beneficial also. But I mean, like I said, all the swearing, the drink, and the womanizing, that's the kind of thing that I think isn't really, I mean, I don't need to be fighting people on Saturday nights anymore. It doesn't look good in a police record anymore, you know. I don't have my gun to get me out of trouble. So I mean, like I said, there's a lot of things I did that I'm real proud of. I'm trying to, you know, maintain those identity of, and a few things I'm trying to grow out of. But like I said, bad habits are hard to drop though, right? So it was, yeah.
You mentioned you were the president for Bets for Vets, and did you start that this year?
Yeah, this semester. So this is like my first semester doing it. And before this, I was the spring semester. So fall semester, I was the vice president. And leading up to that, I pretty much volunteered here. I essentially, like, they had like peer-to-peer programs where during a SOAR program, you get new veterans coming in, and you meet them, and whoever's interested, you just exchange information, like your name and phone number. And if they have any questions about getting around campus, register for classes, or just, you know, meeting people or get more involved, they have someone to call and talk to, you know? So they're not sitting up, or if they're just having a long, crazy night where they're sitting in their room by themselves, you know, they want to talk to someone, you're just kind of there for them. Which, you know, at first, I mean, it's ironic, because that's how like I first started, and the people I would see in the peer-to-peer program are now the guys working around me, you know. So it's kind of like you're always kind of transitioning to the future, where the guys in front of you are teaching you as they're moving on, to the point where now you're teaching what's behind you as you're moving on. So kind of that point where it's like a desire to be here at the President's Club, but it's kind of sad to see the guys before me kind of going, and I'm just hoping I can help some guy who would have been me 2 years ago walking that door, who just needs someone to hold on to and just to feel like he's normal again, you know. So yeah, I mean, I love it. I mean, it's a lot more work than I expected. And the hard thing is, like I said, it's always kind of like self-motivated and self-directed. It's like you're acting on behalf of your vets of what you wanted to do or where to go, you know. And people before you had an idea where they wanted to go, and it's primarily the same direction, but it's just small projects that make took a big identity they just try to keep up and do. So I just hope that, you know, we're reaching. And the one thing I hate, gosh, I just hate, is like for you to talk to someone and for them like not to know like what the word veteran means, or like what the word, like we're currently like in two wars right now overseas, and you have people who are for 10 years now sacrificing their entire life, you know, to serve their country, and people are coming back with problems, you know. And I mean, and I just find it almost offensive that some of these people are oblivious to what's going on. We're more worried about what Lindsay Lohan's wearing to fucking court than that we just lost four Marines in a gun battle, you know. And pretty soon, I mean, granted, whether you agree with it politically or not, you should still at least support and be, you know, memorable of the people who are sacrifices. So the one thing I try to do is just kind of like, I mean, well, Madison has a history of being like, not being a kind of anti-war, I guess you'd say. But now they're a lot more supportive, but at least to make the people aware of, you know, who we are, the sacrifices we made, and, you know, how we can help either ourselves or interact with each other a bit more. Because, I mean, I went upstairs to the radio station to promote our guest speaker, and I told the woman that, she's probably 1920, that he was an IEF veteran. I think it was IEF veteran. And she asked me what that meant. And I was like, Operation Enduring Freedom? And I was like, that's Iraq? Or, you know, Afghanistan? Do you ever hear those countries? I mean, it's just like, she was oblivious to it, you know. And people talk about IEDs, or, I mean, it's just like people, I don't know, it can be kind of, you know, frustrating. But, I mean, as a group, I mean, I'm just trying to, as an organization, help the student body understand this pipe, you know, how veterans are when they come back, and interact and make people merge again, and, like, take everyone's good qualities and, you know, bring something productive out of what anybody can bring to the table, you know. That sounds kind of weird, but I'm trying to be on. What? I don't know. Okay. I want interaction with veterans and students to be a little more involved, and I want both parties to benefit from their interactions. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So how long do you think you'll be involved with Vets for Vets then?
Probably till I graduate.
Yeah.
Whether it's in an officer's position or whether it's in a, you know, less important role, but I plan, I mean, I don't see myself leaving here anytime soon. Like I said, it's a big part of me, and I actually really, really enjoy it. So, I mean, I'm sure someone else will become president, and maybe I might want to slow down and my credit load gets a little more heavy, but, I mean, I want to stay involved as much as possible. I mean, they got all sorts of great programs and participations that they're involved in. I just want to see to keep on growing, keep on growing. And I think just like 2 years ago, when at the point when I first walked in here, they had like a membership of like three or four people, something very small. They kind of went through a period where they just went really like in the low point, and now it's growing. I just want to see it keep going and going. And I think, I mean, even back to like the whole comment on campus, I mean, there's even veterans out there on campus who don't know we even exist. And it also irritates me. It's like, you know, we are here for you guys. It's like, I should be the one reaching out to you guys. So I'm just trying to like figure out a way to get our name out there so everybody is aware of us, whether they need our service or they don't need them. So, I mean, if there's 500 student veterans on campus, 499 have better know we exist. You know, whether they want to come here or not, they better know, you know, we advise stuff for them. And I think that's kind of like our goal now is to do that, you know. And then once these members, you know, once these veterans know who we are, it's like, how can they participate to make campus better? And like this oral history project, I mean, I would love to have, you know, 10 other veterans who are just students or volunteers be allowed to do this stuff also, get more involved, and like have different veterans like lead on projects. And I think we're getting to that point with the membership that we're going to be able to start doing that now, which is kind of nice, you know. And a lot of times I can understand that the conflicts with, like, you know, family and school is hard to do. I mean, like, some of these guys are, like, older guys with, like, wives and kids. It's hard to differentiate time. But, I mean, the ones who can sacrifice time, I mean, we really appreciate it. So we're looking forward to having keep on doing it. Until I graduate, I plan on being involved the best I can.
So. All right, yeah. So now that you've kind of had a little bit of time away from being in the Marines and everything, looking back, do you feel good or bad about your time spent there, and maybe what are some things you wish would have been different, or was everything what you wanted to be?
I mean, it was by far the absolute best decision I think I've ever made in my life. I mean, like I said, when I was 18, and my buddies were filling their college applications, like, I did not want to go to college. I mean, I would have gotten fat, lazy, flunked out, had an STD, and, like, had nothing left in my life by the time I was 21, you know? I didn't see any future for me, you know? And the Marine Corps brought me that structure, brought me that challenge, brought me that discipline, brought me that goal-drivenness. I mean, it just, like, was an environment of where I could just, like, thrive in. I mean, I was pretty productive in a lot of sports stuff growing up, and it was just, like, I needed, like, a challenge, and it provided me for it. And like I said, it took me to places and introduced me to people who I never thought I'd ever meet or be, you know? And it really opened my eyes to a lot of things, and it set me up for success. Like I said, I mean, and I had the ability in my service, you know, to choose to do right or wrong. And I was fortunate to, you know, get out of there, you know, with a clean slate and, you know, use that as a stepping stone for me to move on with my life. And I think it wasn't until, I mean, when I joined the Marine Corps, I was going to do my full 20 years and retire in the Marines. And then, you know, after a while, I kind of realized it wasn't really maybe what I wanted for the rest of my life. I mean, and obviously there was a lot of good and a lot of bad times when I was serving, but when I look back now, all I can remember is the good times. And when I call my buddies, that's like, we just have the good times. But I mean, there's definitely some very stressful situations, but I mean, it was just kind of like at the times you say, just suck it up. I mean, that's what you're there for. I mean, things are going to get hard, and that's what you're signed up for. So, I mean, I don't really have any regrets. I mean, I feel like everything I did, I was justified in, and I mean, I was proud of what I did. So, I mean, yeah, I think I made a lot more friends than enemies when I left out of that place. I think it set me up for success here, so that's for sure.
Yeah. So you mentioned you are majoring in zoology, mm-hmm. and you hope to go on to a physical therapy program.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any other concrete plans for the future, or any overarching goals you kind of want to achieve within the next 5, 10, 25 years?
I don't know, not really off the top of my head. I mean, when I was in Finland, I met my fiance, so I plan on marrying her next year and maybe bring her here for a while. And depending on how school goes, I mean, I'll pursue a degree in physical therapy. If it doesn't work out, might work for the Department of State and work security for embassies again. But ideally, if I had to say 10 years from now, I would say I'm happily married with a wife and kid, and then, you know, living life as a physical therapist somewhere in hometown America, and then maybe I wouldn't mind retiring in Finland, maybe having a lake house and just drink beer and fish until I die.
Hey, sounds good. So that's pretty much it. The last thing, always at the end of the interview, I just want to ask, is there anything you feel like that we haven't covered that you want to add that you think should be on record about anything, military, UW, your experience, anything?
Well, I mean, like, just the UW campus, like I said before, it's changed a lot as far as, like, the acceptance of, like, veterans and, like, people returning home. I had an uncle who served in Vietnam. He came back, he had a really hard time with his transition, and he ended up starting going to the VA hospital a lot, but, you know, recollections of things he encountered when he was overseas in a combat zone, they just couldn't really cope with, and the doctors, you know, provided the assistance they felt like was sufficient for him, and at a point where they said, we can't help you anymore, and it led to him being unable to cope with it, and he ended up committing suicide, which is pretty hard on my family. I mean, I never met the man, but I knew my father has some pretty hard residual feelings from it. And it's now that this war is going on that you see your friends and my peers come back, and a lot of them are coping with a lot of the same issues. And and I'm not going to say it's different. I mean, a lot of veterans from all wars have been, I mean, whether it's combat stress or, you know, the shakes, whatever they call it, but there's a problem, like they call them non-visible wounds of war, you know? And I think we just got to make sure that, you know, you respect people's, you know, and you provide them the help to do. And I think the VA and other support groups are reaching out and now providing services and recognizing that, you know, post-traumatic stress is a serious thing, and that, you know, even TBI potentially alters, you know, mood swings and personalities. And then we can no longer, you know, just kind of like, you know, write them off, or, you know, there's too many homeless veterans, too many people out there who've done so much for the country that it's just like, you know, we gotta, like, you know, understand that they have a hard time transitioning, and we gotta, you know, find ways to help them out. We just can't live on the wayside if they can't make it, you know. And it's like, you ever see that? I mean, and obviously it's up to the veteran also out there and seek the help they need, but it's groups like us who should be the ones out there telling them what a veteran deserves, you know. It's like, you know, we should be the ones in their face and, hey, you have these rights, you have these benefits, and, you know, this is what, you know, we can get you. And I mean, it's all different kinds of methods of coping. I mean, and the least one we want to see is, you know, alcohol and drug abuse, you know. And there's too many people who, you know, end their life too early because of the things they experienced in the past, you know. And it's like, we can't change what people have seen and done, but we can try and provide a support group, whether it's like a coffee chat group that's focused on anything other than military experiences, whether people expressing themselves through like writing or memoirs or art, or, I mean, it's just like, or even it's just like sitting around with buddies and never talk about it again kind of thing. But it's just like, you gotta find a way to constructively deal with the issues and not just to put them off. And I feel like a lot of times with this, people, I don't want people to forget what people are doing forget what veterans are doing from right now, or service members. So when they come home, they should be like welcome arms and a little bit of understanding of like to attempt to help or understand or assist them in their transition, because my transition was difficult for me, but there are so many more out there whose transition is much, much more difficult. I mean, yeah, I got a good friend of mine in from high school who we went into service together. He went in the Army, and I went to the Marines, and his story is a lot different. I mean, he ended up going to a tank brigade, and his military experience is completely different from mine. So when we meet up together, I mean, it's just, I mean, he needs help. He's getting it at the pace he needs, but he's got to open up to it. And I just would like people to be a little more aware of that, a little more sensitive to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, definitely. Yeah, man. But yeah, is there any other questions?
No, that's it.
All right, well, thank you, man. Hopefully this helps you out with whatever you're working on.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate it.